I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, when you are looking for selections for your child's library or for gifts for the other little people in your life, you may have looked for books with that gold or silver sticker from the American Library Association. It's their seal of excellence, if you will. Well, their picks for best kids books came out yesterday, and we will speak with one of the winners a bit later in the program. And if you're looking to fill the toy box, we will be talking about why toys are so often marketed to either boys or girls, and we'll talk about whether it has to be that way. That's our parenting conversation. But first, grab your popcorn. The Academy Award nominations were announced today. Joining us to talk about which movies and actors shined and who got left on the cutting room floor is Wesley Morris. He's a film critic with the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Wesley. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Hello. How are you?
Well, I'm better now that I'm talking to you about this.
Aww.
Even though it always makes me feel bad because I'm thinking about all the films that I missed because you still won't babysit like I keep asking you. Come over so I can catch
up. You keep bringing that up.
I know. Well, let's start big. The Martin Scorsese picture Hugo had the most nominations with 11, including, of course, for Best Picture. What's so special about this film?
You tell me, Michelle.
Oh, no.
I mean, that's not fair. Martin Scorsese's movie it's good. The people who love this movie, they really love it. My problem with it is basically that it's about film preservation, and it's one of Martin Scorsese's pet projects. He loves that, and I think it's a beautiful thing to want us to care about. And it's an interesting way, you know, using the story of a kid and his, you know, this mysterious man that he finds working in a train station is a great vehicle for that. It's just not a timeless movie to me. It feels very much, it's not political, but from a cinematic standpoint, it kind of is. It's sweet, but pointed in a way. And I think that people who love this movie kind of love its innocence.
All right.
You've seen better from our friend Martin Scorsese.
Well, we'll see. And another one of the big winners was The Artist with 10 nominations. Mm-hmm. And I would play a clip, but it was a silent film. And
We just won't say anything.
But it was reported that by the Telegraph in the UK that some people walked out of the theater and requested refunds because they didn't realize it was a silent film. So tell me what you thought.
What is wrong with people? I don't understand.
They don't read your reviews ahead of time.
That would break Harvey Weinstein's heart since he's pouring a lot of money into trying to get people to see it and understand why they're there. You know, this is a movie. You know, what's interesting about these nominations to me is that there is a kind of return to some distant era. You know, Scorsese's movie is set in a train station, you know, many, many, many decades ago. The Artist is set during the silent era and is itself a silent movie. And I think the resistance with The Artist, I think if people are resisting it, I think it's that they're being told it's something they should want to see without actually having had the opportunity to sort of decide whether they want to see it on their own. So it takes on this medicinal quality that I think kind of harms it in the public's eye, I think.
Well, that's interesting because there's one more film that we want to talk about where that criticism is being made. It's not nominated yet because it just came out. So let's hold that thought for a minute. We're talking about the Oscar nominations that were just announced today. My guest is Wesley Morris, film critic for the Boston Globe. All right, well, let's talk about the women who shined on the screen, The Help. Very controversial film. It's one of those polarizing films. You got to kind of tread lightly before you ask your friends about whether they liked it or not.
Did you notice that we took a deep breath before you said, yeah.
Four nominations. Here's a clip featuring Best Actress nominee Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer, who's a nominee for Best Supporting Actress. And worth mentioning that Octavia Spencer's already been honored by the Golden Globe. So here it is.
Hold on, those are Miss Hillis. She looked like the winning horse at the Kentucky Derby. All them flowers and bows.
Got that paprika on them.
Oh. Forgive me, Lord, but I'm going to have to kill that woman, Abilene. Now she going to put pencil marks on the toilet paper.
Did she?
Mm-hmm. But I carry paper in from my own damn house. That fool don't know.
Now, okay, deep breath. This is a film that was based on the best-selling novel, on the bestseller list for just weeks and weeks and weeks, if it isn't mm-hmm. still there, about mm-hmm. sort of telling the story of African-American maids in the kind of the civil rights era and kind of their story and how.
Yeah, I mean, look, you just played that clip and my eyes kind of welled up a little bit because what you... there's two ways to go about feeling about this movie. The one is the movie itself and like what those two women do to you. And the Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer are really good in this movie. I think they'll both win, by the way. But you know, then you have the sort of meta problem, which is what they're doing in this movie and what else you've seen Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer do this year. And this was it. These were the two biggest parts for any actress in any movie, for any black actress in any movie all last year. And you kind of have to ask yourself in 2010 or 2011, 2012, why that persists. That's always been my question with this movie.
Yes. And that's one of those deeper conversations that people either get it or they don't. You know what I mean? It's one of those conversations people either get it or they don't. Worth mentioning, Jessica Chastain was also nominated for Best Supporting Actress. And so, you know.
She's really good in that movie, too. And she, amazingly enough, she could have not made the cut because she had six movies that she was eligible for last year.
But that tells you something, doesn't it? Whereas Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer do not.
Michelle, it's a different show.
There it is. A long one. As for Best Actor, George Clooney, nominated for The Descendants, who, as expected, he also was just honored by the Golden Globes. This is a very beautiful, interesting movie out of Hawaii, but we only have a minute left, so I want to talk about Demian Bashir, who starred as an illegal immigrant in A Better Life. Yes. It was a bit of a surprise for some people.
It's been a building surprise, but when the Screen Actors Guild nominated him, a couple months ago, it began to make people open their eyes and say, whoa, what is going on there? What are people seeing in this movie that nobody saw?
Tell me, what is it that you think people saw? As we mentioned, it's about an illegal immigrant who's trying to figure out how to stay in this country so he can take care of his son.
Well, it's not just any. He's a gardener in Los Angeles. And this is no pun intended, it's in people's backyards. And this guy is telling a story that a lot of the people who are in the academy have deal with in some way because they hire guys like this to work for them. And he's trying to live the American dream, so to speak, and it takes a horrible turn. It's a very quiet, dignified performance. He's really good. I'm shocked they noticed it.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Wesley Morris, film critic for the Boston Globe. He joined us from Boston. Wesley, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Fox is getting into the lucrative Spanish language TV market here in the U.S. They're putting together a broadcast network that will begin airing this fall. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, it's a partnership with RCN, a Colombian television company.
RCN is a major producer and exporter of Spanish language programming. They're the ones who created the original Ugly Betty.
Buen hijo.
Betty, Betty, usted no puede hacer eso.
Fox International has partnered with RCN to take advantage of the growing Latino market in the U.S. and because they believe Mundo Fox can do better than the Spanish programming that's currently available, says Fox International's Hernan Lopez.
We think there's an untapped opportunity for viewers that want to see television in Spanish, but they're just not happy with the kind of programming that is available to them.
Lopez says Mundo Fox programming will include sports, entertainment, movies, and news.
It's really a very interesting contender for Univision and Telemundo. I was very impressed.
Juan Tourneau heads up the marketing consulting firm Cultural Strategies. He thinks with such a major corporation supporting it, Mundo Fox could be a game changer for the Latino market in the U.S.
It's bigger than some small nations. It's very interesting and it will continue to grow.
And Tourneau offers the new network a challenge.
I really, truly would like Mundo Fox to show more thought than cleavage.
One of the shows to be featured on Mundo Fox is called Kadabra.
And that's a fantasy and religion-themed weekly drama with very high production values.
High production values, and says Lopez, starring one of Mexico's most popular actors, Christopher Uckerman.
Pero a mí este lugar me gusta.
Mundo Fox might give Univision and Telemundo some stiff competition, but they won't be easy to beat. Just last week, Univision outperformed CBS and NBC in the all-important 18-34 demographic. And that's with telenovelas that don't look all that highly produced. Mundo Fox is scheduled to launch this fall. Hernan Lopez says it will also carry news programming that he says will be independent from the American Fox News. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
This is NPR. Finally this hour, a story of a bakery started by Jewish immigrants and rescued by Pakistani Muslim immigrants. Coney Island Bialy's and Bagels claims to be the oldest Bialy bakery in New York City. It was founded in 1920, but it's faced hard times and changing demographics. As NPR's Margot Adler reports, the bakery is still alive and still kosher.
Coney Island Bialy's and Bagels makes everything by hand the old-fashioned way. Zafaryab Ali, who worked in the bakery for 11 years before leaving to drive a cab and now runs the shop along with his partner Pirzada Shah, gives me the abbreviated bagel tour.
Cinnamon raisin, plain bagel, sesame, poppy I have, onion, pumpernickel.
It's a small store, being slowly renovated in a kind of rundown area on Coney Island Avenue, but the customers know what they like.
Scoop out the dough on both sides with a little butter.
Jeannie Whitson works in a nearby store.
I love their bialys, and I like their flagels.
What are
That's
these?
A flat bagel. Then that is doughy.
And today you're getting what?
I'm getting cranberry with a little butter.
The store was founded by Morris Rosenzweig, who came from Bialystok at the turn of the century, where bialys originated. Bialys usually have an indentation in the middle, but it's not a hole like a bagel, and often some onions in the middle or other flavoring. At one point, the bakery did so much business it was open 24 hours a day on the weekends. Later, the store was run by his son and then by Steve Ross, his grandson, now in his 50s.
By the time I was 10, 11 years old, I was working a cash register. I had to stand on a milk case. By 12, 13 years old, I was, you know, making bialys. By 16, I was rolling bagels. You know, so I worked literally the bottom up.
Ross also worked as a firefighter until he got injured on the job. He's had three surgeries. He couldn't easily commute from New Jersey to take care of the shop. Also, the neighborhood changed. Ross says many of the traditional customers moved to the suburbs. He tried to sell the business. There were no buyers. And when Ali heard about it, Ross asked him, want to take it over?
And then we take charge. Then I say, okay, we'll try, you know.
Shah and Ross say not much has changed.
I'm using same recipe, same ingredients from same suppliers.
I gave them all the phone numbers. If you need, you know, this is who you're going to get it from. And they stayed with all that.
For the bagels, that means high gluten flour, brown sugar, liquid malt, making them by hand, not by machine, boiling them, not steaming them before they are baked. As for keeping the bakery kosher.
Kosher and halal is very, very close, like a brother and sister, maybe twin, you know.
Ali and Shah say the only thing remaining is official kosher supervision and certification.
Very soon we go to bring rabbi for blessing.
I'm looking for that.
Ross, Shah, and Ali talk to each other at least several times a week. They all say business is picking up. And when people look askance at the idea of Muslims running a kosher Jewish bakery, Ross has this response.
They were reliable. I taught them everything. There was never any arguments. I wish them well.
Truthfully, I didn't want to believe these bagels were any better than those at my local deli, which are half the price. But the verdict after buying a dozen and bringing them back to the office, my deli lost. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
Our program is directed by Monica Evstatieva, edited by Corey Turner and Allison McAdam, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. We had engineering support from Chris Nelson.
Our planning editors are Jerry Holmes and Julia Buckley. The staff includes Art Silverman, Jonathan Baer, Rob Ballinger, Brendan Banaszak, Greg Dixon, Theo Balcom, Melissa Gray, and Jessica Deal.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Disputes on climate change are often presented in the familiar paradigm of a court case, with scientists as prosecutors, skeptics as the defense, and the rest of us, the jury, awaiting the ruling of a judge. In an op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times, historian Naomi Oreskes objects. She argues that most of the skeptics are shills, scientists are in fact the jury, and that their verdict has long since been handed down. Naomi Oreskes is the co-author of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscure the Truth About Climate Change, and joins us now from a winter vacation in Snowmass, Colorado. And thanks very much for taking a break today to speak with us.
Thank you, Neil. Can you hear me?
We can. And I have to say that while the vast majority of scientists agree the Earth is warming as a result of human activity, a vast majority does not mean unanimity. It's not unanimous.
No, of course not. And, you know, I'm a historian of science. Most of my work is focused on the question of how scientists do evaluate evidence and judge the data that they collect from the natural world. And so, of course, in any scientific community, there will always be people who have dissenting opinions, and that's fine. Nobody really has a problem with that. The problem is when it's misrepresented. The problem is when the normal give and take of scientific debate is misrepresented to make it seem different than it really is. So in the scientific community today, and not just today, but actually for the last 10 years at least, if not longer, there has been a general consensus that climate change was underway, and we're talking about climate change caused by things that people do, not the normal ups and downs of weather and natural variability, but a different new phenomenon caused by greenhouse gases and deforestation. There has been general agreement in the scientific community about this issue for quite some time now. The vast, vast majority of scientists who work on this issue would agree with that statement.
And you draw, again, an analogy to a court case. You were serving as a juror recently and say that, you know, in a sense, we should not be open-minded. What did you mean by that?
Well, right. And it was, of course, being a little deliberately provocative. But the point I was trying to make was drawing on an analogy with the jury. So this was a great experience because we had a wonderful judge. And one of the things she said to us at the very beginning, and this I wrote about this in the op-ed piece, she asked us at the very beginning during jury selection, if I sent you out right now, and then asked you to come back, and this is before we'd heard any evidence, and before the jury had even been impaneled, if I asked you, do you think these people, the defendants, are guilty, not guilty, or you don't know enough to know, and the vast majority of people in the room raised their hands for, we don't know enough to know. And the judge said, that's the wrong answer. That in this case, open-mindedness is not the correct answer because the law establishes a presumption of innocence. The law tells us that those defendants are innocent, presumed innocent, until the prosecution has proved the case beyond a reasonable doubt. And it was a kind of eureka moment for me because I thought, oh, of course, the judge is completely correct here. We think of open-mindedness as a virtue, and in many walks of life, it is a virtue. But there are some situations when the situation calls for something else. In the courtroom, it calls for us to assume that the defendants are innocent until the state makes its case against them. So then I thought about, well, what about in the case of science? Well, science is a little different. It's not exactly the same as a courtroom. Innocence and guilt don't really make much sense when we're talking about science in the natural world. So then the question becomes, well, who is making this judgment? And so the argument I was trying to point out is that as ordinary citizens, many of us feel, well, we don't know what to think. You know, we've heard a lot of conflicting things about climate change. So, and I've heard many people say to me, I'm open-minded about it. And so the argument I was trying to make was to say, well, in this case, being open-minded, although it might sound good at first, it may sound good in principle, it actually doesn't make sense when you have now more than half a century of accumulated scientific data put together by thousands of different scientists all around the world, men and women, black and white, Republicans, Democrats, you know, all, you know, very diverse scientific community, over half a century of work. At this point, to say that you're still open-minded is to really be ignoring this huge body of scientific evidence that really points to a very, very strong conclusion.
Naomi Oreskes, a professor of history and science professor at the University of California, San Diego. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. If the evidence is so overwhelming, why is it that this argument seems to be losing traction?
Right. Well, this was the subject of a book which I published last year with my co-author, Eric Conway, called Merchants of Doubt. And in the book, we asked exactly that question. We said, well, if there's so much scientific evidence, why do so many of us have the impression of a raging scientific debate? And so we spent 5 years researching this question. And, you know, it's funny for me because it's funny for me to even be having to have this conversation because I first published on the scientific consensus on climate change back in 2003. So I've now been working on the consensus piece for almost a decade. But for the last 5 years, Eric Conway and I have been working on this question of why so many of us think there's a raging debate. And what we showed in the book is that there have been systematic efforts organized by people outside the scientific community to undermine the scientific data and to convince all of us that the jury, the scientific jury, was still out in order to delay government, business, and community action on taking steps to prevent further man-made climate change.
A conspiracy theory?
No, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's a history. We're describing events that have happened. We're describing the things that people have done. There are organizations. There are networks. It's not a conspiracy in the sense that it's not taking place in smoke-filled rooms. In fact, one of the sort of remarkable things about our book was that we were able to show how much of this activity took place in open air, in plain sight. A lot of the research we did wasn't actually that difficult to do. Many of the documents we found were in the public record. So it's not a conspiracy in the sense of, you know, creepy, evil people in back rooms doing terrible things. No, it's actually out in the open, which in some ways makes it more shocking and in a way more alarming that the media haven't done more to talk about the events that have actually taken place in the last 5 years to convince the American people that there was a debate, an argument that really flew in the face of a huge amount of evidence.
There is your case is not bolstered when stories come out. This publication of emails by scientists in England who seem to be, though not fabricating data, suppressing publication of data that seem to fly in the face of their conclusions.
Well, exactly. And, of course, this is where the media have played a huge role, because that is exactly how the story was told in the media, you know, a year or so ago. But what we know now from many different investigations that have taken place, including the House of Lords in Britain, is that those emails were completely taken out of context, very much misrepresented. And what was the real give and take of scientific debate, and also the real frustration that scientists feel at the misrepresentation of their work, was taken massively out of context. And, you know, you mentioned that this took place in England. Earlier in the show, you mentioned that Meryl Streep had her 17th Oscar nomination for portraying Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. And I thought, you know, that's a great thing to remind people about, because Margaret Thatcher was one of the first political leaders to understand the threat of the human-caused climate change. And she created the Climate Research University at East Anglia, where these emails were stolen from, created that institute more than 30 years ago to ask and answer this exact question. How do we tell the difference between natural climate variability that takes place all the time, normal natural climate change, versus what we could call abnormal or even synthetic climate change that is being caused by greenhouse gases and deforestation? That was the question that Mrs. Thatcher posed to the British scientific community more than 30 years ago, and that question has really been answered beyond a reasonable doubt.
You also, speaking of smoke-filled rooms, draw an analogy to the so-called debate over tobacco's health.
Well, exactly. And this was a major topic in our book. And that's where the true conspiracy, of course, comes in, because the tobacco industry, the American tobacco industry, was in fact found guilty by the U.S. Department of Justice, charged under the RICO statutes with criminal conspiracy to defraud the American people. And one of the things we were able to show in the book is that some of the exact same people, not just the same tactics, but actually the same individuals who had worked for the tobacco industry and developed the strategy for which they were convicted of criminal conspiracy by the U.S. Department of Justice, those same people have been involved in some of the attempts to undermine and challenge the scientific evidence of human-caused climate change.
Naomi Oreskes, thanks very much. We'll let you get back to your vacation.
Thank you so much. And thanks to the Snowmass Ski Company for letting me use their phones to take this call and do this interview.
Naomi Oreskes, Professor of History and Science Studies at the University of California in San Diego. Tomorrow, we're taking political junkie Ken Rudin on the road with us to Orlando. We'll talk about the Republican race in the Sunshine State, the President's State of the Union message, and much more. Join us for that. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.
Whether you're into football, baseball, hockey, or hoops, fantasy sports have taken off in a big way. They generate almost $2 billion a year. Commentator Laura Lorson is big on fantasy leagues, just not so much with the sports.
Another football season is winding down. College basketball is uninteresting until the tournament. Pro basketball is, you know, whatever. And it'll be a while before pitchers and catchers show up for spring training. But fortunately for all of us, we are smack in the middle of cold and flu season. And the action in my cold and flu fantasy league is really heating up. I pour over issues of the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report like it's a racing form. I'm trolling the internet for hints on what the up-and-comer viruses might be from the Journal of the American Medical Association and the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, everybody knows about WebMD, which has undeniably solid information and background, but my secret weapon in drafting the real sleeper virus picks? Telehealth Ontario. The Canadians rarely steer you wrong. Basically, you're looking to pick up under-the-radar illnesses. Take coronavirus, causes the common cold. Undeniably solid, the Tom Brady of communicable disease, eventual Hall of Famer, total game day player. You want to start coronavirus every week. But everybody knows about coronavirus. So what you really want to look for is the solid performer the fair-weather fans haven't necessarily heard of, maybe has kind of mediocre jersey sales, but is super contagious and hard to stop. Last year, I pinned a lot of my strategy on rotavirus, which totally fit that profile. I have a friend who works in a daycare center, and she gave me the tip. I also went ahead and drafted listeria because I had heard someplace that USDA funding was under attack. Kind of a mediocre pick, actually. My coworker, though, who drafted E. coli, totally cleaned up, but then he had a higher salary cap than I did. I'm not having a great season, but it ain't over till it's over. The weather could get worse. More people could be staying indoors, sneezing on each other. I got stuck with diphtheria in a really boneheaded trade I made earlier this year, but I had a hunch a few weeks ago, and I picked up pertussis on waivers, since the two kind of go together, what with all these people refusing to get their kids immunized. I also have kind of a big stake in flu, which is always risky. It's either feast or famine with flu. It either has a monster season or it's a total bust. I drafted H1N1, which historically has had absolutely mind-blowing statistics, but I haven't started him this year. Good to know he's on the bench, though. When the virus strain that started the 1918 pandemic takes the field, people sit up and take notice. At least people at the CDC do. Anyway, if you could do me a favor, I'd really appreciate it if you could be a little more lax about hand-washing here in the next couple of weeks. If I'm going to win this league, I'm going to need your help. So go on, go to work with your sniffles and your productive cough. Your boss and your coworkers will think you're really dedicated, and I, quite frankly, could use the points. Winning this year's Cold and Flu Fantasy League may not have quite the cachet of winning at Fantasy Football or Rotisserie League Baseball, but it would really be a confidence booster for me this coming spring when I'm getting my Westminster Kennel Club dog show bracket picks together during Mutt Madness.
Laura Lorison is thinking about starting a Real Housewives of Beverly Hills Fantasy League at her home in Perry, Kansas.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.